From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. When did radio last touch you? Well, actually, it's touching you right now. Sound waves of my voice and the music under my voice are causing your eardrums to vibrate. Your brain, in turn, interprets that vibration as sound. But what happens when the sound stops? Now, of course, sound didn't really stop. Radio did for a moment, but the white noise of your life, the hum of a fluorescent light or the sound of a distant airplane, that continued and continues now, touching you, even while you listen to me. This hour, join us for an exploration of touch and sound. First up, Dame Evelyn Glennie will shatter the way you think about sound and touch. She's a Grammy Award-winning solo percussionist and composer with over 20 albums under her belt. Glennie performs every year with the world's greatest classical music conductors and orchestras, as well as with such artists as Bjork, Bobby McFerrin, and Bella Fleck. Evelyn Glennie is one of the greatest percussionists alive today. Evelyn Glennie is deaf. Steve Paulson spoke with Glennie about touching sound.
How important is touch to music?
Well, we know that to feel and to hear are really the same things. And, you know, there's no such thing as complete silence. I think that only really is experienced when no motion happens, when something is completely static. So possibly the equivalent of death. I mean, this is why I don't believe there's such a thing as total deafness. I think that, yes, sound may not necessarily be perceived through the ears, but it can certainly be perceived through the body. And of course, to perceive sound through the body and using your body as some sort of resonating chamber, that has to take practice. And, you know, listening skills is about concentration, it's about focus. It's really digesting what is actually going through that body. In the same way that if suddenly you cut off the top or block the top of a marimba resonator or pipe, then the sound doesn't resonate. I'm sure if you covered up, you know, part of the body of a viola or a violin or cello or something, it would be a completely different type of sound, possibly more choked. So we have to open that instrument up. And likewise, our bodies, you know, they are the instrument at the end of the day, and we have to open the body up in order to perceive sound. The great thing about percussion, of course, is that really, you know, the body is often in a very natural position, like a singer, and so the whole body can actually be open physically to perceive the sound. If you think of the posture of a flute player or an oboist or a trombonist or a string player, the body in general is in an unnatural position. So the sound has to go, you know, try to get sort of through all sorts of corners, the way that the arm is bent and held up in the air in order to hold an instrument, this type of thing. And it's more difficult to perceive sound or higher sounds, and certainly in the upper part of the body, I think it's more difficult to digest those, really. And for me personally, that's why I like to work with low sounds, resonant sounds, and that's why a lot of hearing impaired people, young and old, really like to delve into those types of sounds coming from timpani or the low end of the marimba or bass drums and things that have huge resonance and low frequencies.
Thank you.
remember the first time you touched sound, or at least the first time that you were aware that you were touching sound?
Certainly when I began playing percussion from the age of 12, and this was the time when I was really reliant on hearing aids and phonic ears in the classroom, and at that point, I thought that the only way for me to hear better was for everything to be louder. And of course, that was not the case at all. When things became louder, they became more distorted and much more painful and more disorganized, and my balance was affected. My dynamic range was completely affected, and I had no control over what I was doing or that around me. So actually, I discovered that by taking the hearing aids off, that I actually heard less through the ear, but much more through the body. And the body acted like a resonating chamber, really. So this was a hugely important step. And so I had a wonderful percussion teacher at school who also, you know, grew with me. And he had come out with the suggestion of putting my hands on the wall of the practice room or the teaching room, which, you know, this building had very, very thin walls. And lo and behold, you know, you could really feel the sound through your body. There was no question of that. And so we just basically refined that and practiced and became much more aware of what was being perceived. And, you know, that was it. We developed that. So I would say really from about the age of 12 that this awareness came about, and it was really thanks to the vision of my teacher.
It's so fascinating to hear you describe this process, because I think most people would assume that someone who is hearing impaired would have a harder time hearing all these sounds. But I mean, to hear you describe this and to describe all of what you can feel through your touch, it seems like your capacity for hearing is much greater than for most of the rest of us.
I think that the art of listening is something that I'd like to see developed on a much more broad scale in the likes of music institutions. You know, we think of oral training, whereby, you know, we may have to sing back a melody or play back a melody or transpose something or read from a full score or whatever it is. But listening goes beyond that. Those are technical things. But to truly explore the art of listening, I think then the whole body needs to be used and all the senses heightened.
One of the things that's striking about watching you play music is there's often a lot of space within your music, and it seems at times like there's silence sort of in between your notes. But then I guess I wonder if I'm just not hearing the vibrations that you might be feeling as you are sort of letting the music subside before you move on to the next notes.
Well, I don't know, because I don't know what you're actually experiencing, but certainly, you know, it depends on the type of situation. If it's completely solo percussion or if it's percussion with the orchestra, if it's a concerto or something. You know, a good example of this is when you play a snare drum. You can strike a snare drum. We all recognize it as being a snare drum. And we get that initial attack. But we really do miss the life of that sound thereafter. And very rarely do we truly know what a snare drum can do or sound like. So if you strike a drum, just one strike, without any other instrument, then there's a whole kind of orchestra of sounds going on, the resonance of the shell, the tuning of the sticks, the tuning of the drum itself, and of course how the hall deals with that sound. If you play exactly the same strike at the same dynamic level and have a tutti chord from the orchestra, you will perceive none of that from the snare drum. You will literally get that initial attack, and all the life of the sound is then completely covered over by the orchestra or ensemble or whatever it may be. There's a lot of that that goes on with percussion. That's why it's very difficult to write a marimba concerto, because the essence of a marimba is, in fact, what happens after you strike it. Once you've struck something, you can't then manipulate the sound. So unlike a stringed instrument or brass or woodwind instrument, you can start a sound and you might say to yourself, oh, I just like that a little bit fatter or a little rounder or thinner or more loving or a bit harder or whatever it may be. And you can subtly change that as you're creating the sound. With percussion, you don't have that option at all. You strike something and that's your lot. So there isn't such a thing as silence, really. There's always sound. That sound is travelling somewhere. It goes somewhere. I don't know where it goes, but it does go somewhere.
One final question. I don't know if you'd be willing to do this or not, but could you play on the table right in front of you, whatever might be sitting there?
Well, I don't know. I am. We do have these paper clips. I don't know. I don't know if you'll be able to pick it up or what.
Would you be willing to try?
We can try something.
That's Dame Evelyn Glennie playing an empty tape dispenser, a box of paper clips, a piece of paper, and the engineer's keys. Steve Paulson spoke with her. To watch Dame Evelyn Glennie perform, please go to our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, a sound that touches your soul. We'll listen to the silence of one of the most austere monastic orders in the world, the Carthusian monks. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Imagine what it sounded like in 1776. There were no radios, no telephone rings, no car horns, no whirling of your hard drive fan, no refrigerator hum. Richard Rath is the author of How Early America Sounded. He says the sound of early America, the church bell, the town crier, women beating their laundry, had a distinct difference from sound today. Rath says that every sound in early America had a living and willful source.
There were very few things of the sort that we would now call mechanical sounds. So no industry, no automobiles, no engines, no electricity. So most every sound was associated with some form of life.
Let's put this in context, if you will. What would you hear on a regular basis? I mean, we know we walk outside, we hear traffic. We hear planes flying overhead. We hear music blaring. What would you hear in the early American soundscape?
Well, it would very much depend on whether you were in a city or in a rural area. The rural areas would be a lot quieter for the most part. Most of the population at this time was rural. The cities are actually where I found more interesting sounds, though. And the idea that it's quieter in the past doesn't really, I don't think, hold as well for cities.
If you think about wagons rattling by and the conversation of people?
Iron wheels and horse hoofs with iron shoes over cobblestone roads makes a huge racket. And there were noise abatement rules and laws even in the 18th century in Philadelphia. They had complaints that they couldn't conduct church services because of all the noise of the traffic coming by. Actually, one of the interesting things is that bells were a lot louder then because of how they were rung.
How can the bells be louder? You say because of the way they were rung, not because of the sounds around them, but because of the use of the bells?
Yeah. The way that they're rung now, if they haven't been replaced by a tape recording of bells, which probably 90% of the churches now use tapes or some form of recording, when they still use an actual bell, they swing the clapper to hit the bell, and most of the sound goes right into the bell tower. The way they used to ring them was that the bell swung on hinges, and it didn't ring until it was pretty much at a 90-degree angle.
So the mouth of the bell was aimed out.
The mouth of the bell was aimed out, and then the bell tower actually acted as an amplifier to direct the sound out, and then there'd be baffles that directed it down. So the bells were much louder. For example, ship captains used to be able to hear the bells in the middle of the Delaware River in Philadelphia, the bells of Christ Church. Actually, the bells are still there, and it's a few blocks in from the river, but they could hear it like a mile out into the river, no problem. And now you can't even hear them a couple of blocks away. I drove around on a Sunday morning, and it's much quieter now than it would have been in the 18th century.
But what you're saying is that the bells are still there. If we were to go back and ring the bells instead of pulling the clappers, you could still hear those bells in the middle of the river.
Yes, yes. And that's actually one of the points of the book, is that one of the arguments has always been, oh, you can't really do a history of sound because sound is ephemeral and disappears. But actually, if you think about it a little creatively, there's all sorts of sounds that are pretty much the same sounds as they were designed that are available today, and they serve just as well as a paper document for telling us things about the past.
It's fascinating. What happened? Why did the change take place? Why do we pull the clapper instead of ringing the bell?
Well, that's where it gets complex, because sound obviously didn't disappear. In many ways, the world's much louder now, but people attended to it less. But what happened with the bells is really interesting, because they began to be reported in newspapers, and reading about the bells served the same function as listening to the bells formerly did. But because print could reach across regions, people started, first they read about bells in London, but then they started reading about bells in the other colonies, oftentimes protesting what was going on in London. And it helped build an American identity before the revolution, a sense of distinctive Americanness as opposed to being British from finding out what was going on in these other colonies, you know, that they rang the bells to protest the Stamp Act or something like that. You'd read in Boston that they had done the same thing in New York, and all of a sudden you've got more in common with people from New York than you do with British subjects in England.
Well, and because you'd read about the bells being rung, you don't need to hear them. It's almost as though you have heard them because you read about them.
Yes. And actually, the newspaper would say the same things that the bells meant. So when you heard the bells, you were supposed to know, say, it was the king's birthday or that this was for a protest. And that would be printed in the newspaper. So the actual message of the bells was reduced to print as well.
Did early Americans have an understanding, a science of acoustics?
The science of acoustics was very interesting because we think, oh, they just hadn't developed the science of acoustics. But there was a very well-developed science of acoustics where they believed that sound was a particle that actually had a tangible force in the world. So sound did things. Like, people thought that thunder was what killed people, not the lightning.
Did they even understand that there was a relationship between thunder and lightning?
Oh, of course they did, yes. And they talked about whether it was the thunder that killed you or the lightning, and they decided because people who lived had been struck by lightning and didn't hear the thunder, because I guess they were knocked out before the thunder clapped, that was part of the reason that they decided that the thunder was what killed people. But also because the thunder was the voice of God, so that it crossed, like it wasn't just science or just theology, it was both together.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because thunder and lightning obviously are the same, at least I believe they're the same now as they were in early America. But the way in which we perceive them has changed, and that's a huge difference.
Yes. And now this is actually a very decentering and difficult point to get across to people because they just think that, oh, they were just wrong. They didn't know how lightning actually works, that the lightning is what kills people. But actually, it's not the lightning that kills people. It's electricity, and thunder is the audible element of it, and lightning is the visual element. And I use this analogy of two deer standing by the side of the road, and they're arguing with each other over their fallen comrade out in the middle of the road, whether it was the headlights or the horn that had killed them. So it's no more the lightning than the thunder that does the damage. But now we just think, oh, to believe that thunder did it was superstitious and to believe lightning did it is scientific. But it's really a reflection of how much we've become a more visual culture.
Richard Rath is the author of the book How Early America Sounded. You're listening to his recording of the bells at Christ Church in Philadelphia. The bells date back to the 1700s. The Grand Chartreuse in the French Alps is one of the world's most ascetic monasteries. In 1984, German filmmaker Philipp Gröning wrote to the Carthusian Order for permission to make a film about them. Their reply? Maybe. We'll get back to you. 16 years later, Philipp Gröning was surprised to get a letter in the mail, out of the blue, from the monastery. They were ready. So Gröning, without artificial lighting, without a crew, spent 6 months living the life of a monk and filmed. The result was the documentary called Into Great Silence, a film with no score, no voiceover, and no archival footage. A full-length feature film that, like the monks' lives, is almost entirely without words. Philipp Gröning spoke with Anne Strainchamps about his film.
Basically, I set about on two thoughts. One level of thought was, when you do film, you always deal with time. Time is the most powerful and the deepest, but the profoundest tool that you have as a filmmaker. You have image, sound, and time. And when you make a film with the absence of speech and the absence of a sort of evident action, then suddenly that element of time becomes so very, very strong, and you can create an inner space for an audience which will actually alter their perception and which will alter their being, which is very much what a monastery is. So it was creating something that is analogous to a monastery, because a monastery also is a place where the structure of time and the rigidness with which time is structured and you go through your own life in circles, kind of, is changing the monk and is making him approach a certain state of mind. And on the other level, it was very simple that if you want to make a film that's really a spiritual film, you shouldn't speak about spirituality at all, because spirituality or the question of God or the questions of religion are extremely personal for everyone. So the more that the filmmaker would sort of express himself or herself in explaining what this monk is doing right now, the less you would enter your own spiritual space. So it was a simple decision to sort of go in there, live the life they do, rely on the fact that it would change my perception, and open a space for the viewer to find their own spiritual way.
So that rather than explain to the viewer what spiritual life is like, you wanted to bring the viewer as close as possible to them having a spiritual experience of their own?
We live in a time when we have very much information, very much answers, and the profounder level of a human being is the level of questions. So the more answers, the more information, the more explanation you give to people, the more you take them away from the space of questions that they have a right to.
There were some moments in the film when you have close-ups of the faces of the monks and they're just staring right at the camera. Some of the first ones I thought looked really peaceful, really tranquil. I thought maybe I had never seen such peace in somebody's eyes before. And some of the later ones I thought they looked like the faces of people do who have suffered a lot or who have withstood suffering for a long time. But maybe I was reading that into them. What do you think?
Well, I think you're a very precise viewer. I think the very first ones you saw were very old monks who were very high in the hierarchy. In the order, they would say, those are people who are very far advanced spiritually. And then you see the faces of a lot of the younger monks who are actually very much fighting with themselves. There's a saying in the Charterhouse that the first 25 years are really difficult, but then it starts to be really good, right? And I think that's what you see in those faces. And so in the end of the film, again, you see the faces of very old monks and you realize that they are very, very much at ease with themselves. But of course, if it was as easy as that, that you go into a monastery and you chop your own wood and you don't talk very much and you become happy at once, then everybody would do it.
We'd all be lining up at the monastery doors. So what is the nature of the suffering? What is it that's so difficult? I mean, not physically, but in an interior sense.
In an interior sense, of course, the deprivation is also very hard, and also the not being able to speak very much. You do have friends in there. You have friends, like, in the sense that you meet some of the monks in the cloister, and you have smiles at one another, and with others you don't. But it is a very lonely thing, and the absence of language, on the one hand, the presence of objects and the presence of light and of sounds and of what the world is becomes much stronger. But on the other hand, what we are very attached to, all of our sense of logic and of control of the world, that gets lost. And you find yourself hardly being able to make a plan for your very next future. And this is a feeling of very deeply being sort of deprived of the sense of the control that you usually have, which is a process that all monasteries, I think, in all societies aim at. But that is a very big suffering.
It gives you a feeling of great respect for these monks, don't you think? I mean, perhaps the stereotype of a monk is a very gentle, peaceful person, and yet I wound up thinking, these are enormously strong people. They must have tremendous inner strength. And also, these are such risk takers. I mean, what kind of people in our culture are willing to give up everything, absolutely everything, on the chance that they'll gain everything spiritually?
They are very strong. I'm very happy that that comes across. I was surprised how strong they are and how free they are in themselves, and also how radical they are. They're amongst the most radical people I've ever met. Now, for the giving up, they would always say they are not really giving anything up, which I can understand very much. I'm not attached to material things at all, in a way. But basically, you can sort of say to buy a Porsche is not a bad thing in itself. The problem is that the time you waste not making the money, that's not the difficult part, but the time you waste trying to choose which Porsche you should buy and then trying to choose how to keep it in shape and so on, that all takes away so much of your lifetime for completely nothing that it's much better not even to think about it. So they would always say they're not giving up very much. They're just giving up the stuff that is standing between you and your own life.
Tell you that this was watching your film was a fascinating experience, as much in some ways about watching myself as about watching the film. You know, I began sort of watching my own emotional reaction, and after the first sort of bit of fascination with the details of the monks' lives and, you know, figuring, okay, where do they live and how do they get their food, and oh, that's where how their food arrives. But then beyond that, there was a feeling of kind of relief, of pleasure in the silence and the very slow passage of time. I think the best way I could describe it is like taking a really deep breath and realizing that in fact you've been breathing shallowly for days. Do you know what I mean?
Maybe we've all been breathing shallowly for years. I know what you mean when you say that. In a way, when you watch the film, you watch yourself. Which is I'm very happy that you say that, because that's what I tried. I always said I'd try to make a film which would become a monastery, transform itself into a monastery more than explain something about a monastery. And of course, when you're a monk or a nun, you don't go into a monastery in order to learn about monasteries. You go into a monastery in order to learn about yourself. So when you say that the film brings you to your own questions, then that means that it actually does recreate that monastic experience, which is about encountering yourself in order to go deeper.
The monks, occasionally you would record little bits of conversation they have. I think they have some time for conversation once a week for a little bit. They talked at one point about how they see their own life as symbolic. And there are certain symbols that you return to over and over again. During the film, there's a beautiful image of just an empty metal pot drying after it's been washed. What did that image say to you?
Oh, that was just one of the details that was in my cell. When you live alone and you live in silence, you become much more aware of the material objects that are around you. In a certain way, something happens that it seems as if the world, the creation, whatever surrounds you, is like coming towards you and becomes much more alive and much more beautiful. And I wanted to sort of share that with the audience. That's a very simple thing. That's just the tray in which you wash your dishes. And after you've done that, you always have to put it up against the wall to let the water drip off, and then it dries. It just became such a beautiful object. And I thought, that's interesting to show that. It's just a metal thing. And suddenly it's as if it becomes alive, as if it gets a meaning, which is what happens. When you live in a monastery, you realize that all of what you can see, all of what your senses bring to you, is actually helping you enroot yourself in the world and be present in the world in your own life.
If you can slow down enough to look and to see. I mean, it's in some ways what I'm left with after seeing the film. It's those images that stay in my mind. You know, a simple glass sitting on a table and the sunlight shining through it so you can see the little kind of specks and motes of stuff floating in the water, or a piece of fabric hanging and just very gently swaying in the wind. I keep thinking of those images.
That's I think, what all artists and especially all filmmakers have always been trying to do. When you look at the Andy Warhol films, or when you look at the Soderbergh films, or when you look at a lot of films, it's about getting the viewer to be able to see and to hear and to be in their own time when they left the cinema. A bad film stops when it's over. A good film starts when it's over.
Philip Grinnig's documentary about the monks of the Grand Chartreuse is called Into Great Silence, and Strainchamp spoke with him. Still to come, a round-the-world listening expedition of sounds we don't consider, like the first morning yawn of a howler monkey, or the clattering sound of a walrus's teeth. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Our world is full of sound. Just pause for a moment and listen. White noise fills our ears 24/7. Because of this, we've become very good at tuning certain sounds out. Maybe too good? Doug Quinn is a sound artist, and he's trying to tune certain sounds in. He wants to hear and record sounds we don't consider. Like the sound of a spider sucking the blood out of an insect, or the sound of a tree falling in the forest. Doug Quinn took Anne Strainchamps on a round-the-world listening expedition of these sounds we don't consider.
So, Doug, what are we hearing here?
The sounds that you're hearing are recorded underwater using a hydrophone, an underwater microphone, in Bristol Bay in Alaska. And what we're hearing are the gonging sounds and teeth clacking from walruses. These are males generally displaying. And the display has a visual component in the surface, but they dive and they make these beautiful, resonant, full gonging sounds. And this wind-up that you hear with the teeth clacking, they're not...
So that's teeth? I keep wondering, what is that tapping, banging sound? That's their teeth?
Yeah, they're a whole percussion ensemble. To me, it's sort of almost like gamelan in the range of sound that we hear. And you can hear definite sort of percussive phrasing, particularly in the teeth clacking as they ramp up and reach a crescendo and stop. And it's a very, very, very powerful sound. And these are many, many walruses recorded near Round Island, a walrus sanctuary off the coast of Alaska.
So how did you capture this sound? What did you have to do to record it?
I was there for a week, and they had all taken off from their haul out on the rocky beaches of Round Island. And just one evening, about 11 o'clock, we could see them coming back, and so got into a Zodiac inflatable boat and headed out with a hydrophone in hand and just lowered it about 30 feet and listened.
Amazing to think what a rich world there is under the ice in Antarctica. There's another incredible set of sounds that you recorded of Weddell seals kind of calling to each other.
Yes, this is, I think, one of, I consider this a gift in a way, the both the quality of the sound and for sheer musicality. I was really stunned And I think one of the interesting aspects of sound with the recordings of the Weddell Seals is that my first introduction to them sonically was listening to their calls and very powerful chug sounds. They have a wide vocabulary of sounds to draw from. More than 40 calls have been identified. And you can feel it through 8 feet of ice in your bunny boots. So feeling that power, I mean, the decibels are 180 decibels, some of the signal levels, which think of a very loud rock concert and then some.
Sound quite biological, do they? Doesn't it sound like something you'd imagine hearing in outer space?
Exactly. They're so evocative of things we've come to know through music or, outer space. When I first heard it, I thought of classic electronic music from Karlheinz Stockhausen in the 50s, old analog electronic music, and the richness of these tones. I often tell people, for all the computers and synthesizers we have, somehow I'm never quite prepared for what I hear in the natural world.
Somehow thought it would be pretty desolate in Antarctica, and yet, you know, you found these rich sounds, many of them recorded actually under the ice, but there are also some recordings you made just of the ice itself, which I guess somehow it hadn't occurred to me that ice itself would make noise.
That was one of the joys in dice. People say, well, what are you going there? There's nothing there. But on the contrary, it's teeming with life along the coastline and along the sea ice edge, which is where I spent most of my time. The recording that you're listening to here, it has a lot of noise, or what appears to be static, and you have to think of millions and millions, if not billions, of bubbles from brash ice floating around the surface as that melts. Think of ice in a glass melting and multiply that. Then you're hearing the groaning of icebergs as they either turtle or flip over or rub up against each other. So all range of sound, from sort of pitched material, again, the groaning, to these explosions when they break apart, and then the brash ice percolating away.
You know, I think one of the great gifts of listening to some of your recordings is it really hits you so powerfully that the world is alive. I mean, it's hard to think of that as an inanimate thing making that kind of roaring, groaning noise.
Yes, it is that you realize when you take the time to listen, which almost seems a luxury in our fast-paced lives, that everything is in constant motion around us. The air and sound is around us all the time in varying degrees, some of it very subtle and some of it extraordinarily powerful, from glaciers to wind to volcanic eruptions to the delicate sounds of birds and insects. So I think the world is always alive. We can never turn it off or tune it out, really. What emerges for me after long periods, and again, if you spend 6, 7, 8, 10 hours a day doing this, you begin to focus on subtlety. If you can still your mind enough to not be thinking about half a dozen other things competing for your attention at any given moment, you begin to become sensitive to very subtle shifts in pitch, for instance, or frequency, a bird singing near the ground, a low booming sound of a tinamou or a dove, to a songbird high in the canopy, and begin to see a whole matrix of interaction between species as they occupy a very unique habitat. So the act of slowing down opens you up for a broader sense of what's out there in terms of rhythms, how loud or soft things may be, and also the time of day. The passages of the day bring different players into what amounts to a symphony for the day.
Mm. So will you walk us through one of your recordings? There's a recording you made in the Amazon, for instance. To my ears, it simply sounds teeming with sounds, but I'm curious to know what you hear.
What you're hearing here is a recording that was made at canopy level, meaning about 150 feet up in the air, treetop level. And this is just as the sun is breaking. And what you're hearing are howler monkeys calling to one another. I always think of this as announcing the dawn, but also checking in with each other, making sure everyone made it through the night. Their sounds almost remind me of a cannon that's joined by different troops in different locations for miles around. And there are many, many species of birds. They join the dawn chorus. I think in the morning, when the air is moist, sound tends to travel further and retain its shape more. And as the sun burns that moisture off, most animals quiet down a little bit, and then the insect players take over. And this recording has that wonderful transition from the first flush of a dawn chorus with the howler monkeys and birds, and transition into the period when the first insects ratchet to life.
Oh, I love that sort of droning sound that they make.
It's very deep and resonant, and for such small creatures, they do have a big voice.
That is the other incredible thing. I mean, you've been really interested in bird calls, too, and it is extraordinary to realize what rich and incredible sounds these tiny little creatures can make.
Absolutely. I got into this through a passion for just listening in general, but very much inspired by the work of Jane Goodall and John Cage, and I'm fond of telling people I've been vocationally challenged ever since. But with that said, I entered into doing field recording with a real passion and interest in primate communication, and spent a good deal of time chasing various primates around the forest and realized, boy, there's all this other beautiful and wonderful activity. And so you go after one thing, but when you start paying attention, a lot of it is revealed to you if you are indeed mindful in the moment. And so birdsong, it's a natural. One thinks of wildlife, and they're the planet's most wonderful singers in a way. We're listening to the tui bird from New Zealand, an indigenous bird, also known as a parson bird because of its black plumage and a little white tuft under its chin. These birds are infinitely curious and have a lot to say for themselves. One of the things that you can really hear in this recording is, because it's so close, I was only about 5 feet away from the bird as it approached me, but you can hear the ability of this bird to sing multiple notes at one time through their voice box, which is called a syrinx. Unlike our voice box, where we can do one tone at a time, they switch the airflow over these two parts, two chambers in the syrinx, and just produce this wonderfully dense dance of sounds in their vocalization.
Thank you. So what about silence? We haven't talked about silence, and yet in some ways I would think that listening so deeply to all the sounds in the world would make you all that much more sensitive to silence and maybe even make you value silence more?
We're not comfortable with silence, that is, our own silence, because the world is never silent, but our participation in it can be one of a quiet observer. We live in a culture of anticipation. Everything's about the next thing, and we tend to fill our lives. If you look at public spaces like restaurants, they're filled with sound. They're filled with music, not necessarily of your choosing. It's as if we're trying to drown each other out at every turn. So I think it becomes difficult for us to carve out time without thinking that we're somehow wasting time by simply being, simply sitting. And you don't have to go off to the Antarctic, or you don't have to go to a tropical rainforest. This can happen in your own backyard, basically. I think of Antarctica, again, as probably the quietest place on the surface. On a still day, you cannot hear anything except your own pulse. And that's a pretty powerful experience, because it's rare in our lives that we have that kind of opportunity to find the inner stillness that becomes a way of looking at silence or understanding or hearing silence.
Doug Gwynn is a sound artist and designer. He's also a professor of audio at Syracuse University. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. To hear more audio from Doug Gwynn, please go to our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Touching the Sound, program number 32A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.